Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Schiller? All right. Well, we will, Mr. Hotelling, we will take a pass on the first case for the moment and call the second case, United States against Burke.
May it please the court, Michael Nash for the defendant appellant, Robert Burke. Before I begin my argument, Judge, I would like to correct a mistake that appears in my brief, reply brief at page 2 and 3. There is a quote on the top of page 3 that is attributed on page 2 to United States versus Rauscher, a Supreme Court case appearing at 119 U.S. 407. Actually, that's a quote from Puentes, which quotes Rauscher. In the quote, you will see the italics. That part is from Rauscher. The other is the paraphrase by the Puentes court of their reading of Rauscher. I apologize for the mistake. The first question that I would like to address here is to the question of what this extradition was about. And we instruct juries all the time that it is impossible to read the minds of the defendants and the people involved in the case, and to determine what purpose and intent was by examining the circumstances. In this case, after 2 years of fighting extradition, Burke arrived on the soil of the United States pursuant to the British court's order of extradition. The extradition was that he was to serve the remaining portion of a sentence, supervised release, which had not yet been completed. That had been the subject of a great deal of dispute in the British courts, as the British decision exemplifies. What is the first thing the government does? They don't take him to court for that. They question him. Two FBI agents, who were the agents assigned to the investigation of the Erickson escape, question him about the Erickson escape. This is not new for Erickson, not new for the FBI, not new for the U.S. Attorney's Office. They interviewed Burke back when it occurred, and they had his denials on record. Nonetheless,
before we go any further, I realize that since I was worried about the first case, I have forgotten to make an important announcement, which is you're only seeing two of the judges today. Judge Rovner had to go to the hospital early this morning because of a medical emergency in her family, and she will be listening to the recordings of the oral arguments and participating in the decisions of today's cases. We wish her well, but she can't be here today. So,
Mr. Nash, just assume the two of us can handle all the problems without any interference from anybody else.
I think so, Judge. But the question did, when I saw her not come out, I was concerned, so thank you, Your Honor. After they question Burke and he refuses to answer any of their questions and asks for a lawyer, they give him a subpoena. The odd thing about these two things is that in our brief we set forth that the subpoena was served on December 23rd, the day after. But the government, in their brief, takes great pride in correcting that fact and saying the FBI 302 was wrong and that actually he was given the subpoena immediately on the 22nd. It's only then that they take him before the court, the magistrate, because Judge Lindbergh was not available.
By then, you mean when?
On the 22nd.
22nd.
Later the 22nd, yes. But the first thing they do is not attend to the matters which they told the British court were the reason for bringing him. They attend to the Erickson escape. That case is continued before Judge the magistrate to January 9th. On January 9th, it's continued again. And according to the government's brief, negotiations occur about what will happen to Burke. Among those negotiations are negotiations about the subpoena and his testimony and his evidence in the Erickson escape. Nothing happens regarding The reason that he's
refresh
here...
Refresh my recollection. Who were the negotiations and who did they involve?
The assistant U.S. attorney and his appointed lawyer, Mr. Falconer.
Mr.?
Falconer, F-A-L-C-O-N-E-R, a member of the Federal Defender Pen. Was not Mr. Durkin or myself. Not until June of 2001 does the matter get before Judge Lindbergh for resolution of the matter before him. Then they serve him with an immunity order, order him to testify, all before we ever get around to resolving the question for which he is brought here. That isn't resolved until December the 5th, 2001. The odd thing here is that the government basically in their brief confesses in that it says they had no choice. They couldn't prosecute him for the escape, at least not at this trip, at this date. So they had to grant him immunity, and that was clearly their intention from the beginning. They didn't wait a few days. Immediately upon arriving.
You've so far been acting as if there were something wrong with having the intention of questioning him about the events of 1992. What was wrong with it?
Judge,
everyone has a duty to give evidence. He has evidence. He's given immunity, so there's going to be no problem with the terms of the extradition, and he then chooses to lie. What's wrong with asking?
The jurisdiction of this court is limited.
The jurisdiction of this court depends on a timely appeal from a judgment of the district court. And
you're correct, Judge. The jurisdiction of the district court
depends on an indictment, and there's no doubt of that.
Actually, Judge, I disagree. It depends upon the extradition.
No. The jurisdiction of the district court is given by 18 U.S.C. 3746. It depends on an indictment. There is jurisdiction in district courts for all prosecutions of offenses against the United States.
The jurisdiction of Mr. Burke.
Your terms of extradition may or may not be a defense, but it is totally unrelated to federal jurisdiction. Now, let's come back to my question.
Judge, if there is such a thing as a perjury trap, and courts have said there are.
Has this court?
It has in a case, Devitt. You know, it's not cited, though. I don't
not
believe
cited.
In any of the briefs, but it
well,
is.
Then you can't cite it now. There's
the
a certain
government
rule
cites
which
it.
Says you can't.
I understand.
Government cited it?
No. The government cited a case, United States versus Chen, which cites Devitt.
What do you have to say about United States against R Enterprises?
I'm not familiar with that case.
It's a decision of the Supreme Court which raised the very same argument. Somebody is called before a grand jury. The prosecutor knows to a certainty what the truth is. They are very confident that the witness will lie. He does lie. He's prosecuted. And the Court of Appeals, actually your favorite Court of Appeals, given your citations here, the Ninth Circuit, reverses. The Supreme Court reverses 9-0 and says it's perfectly proper to call somebody before a grand jury, even if the prosecutor really knows the truth, even if they're fairly certain that the person will lie, because they're entitled to investigate and the public has a right to every man's evidence. This whole perjury trap business seems utterly inconsistent with a recent decision of the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, if there's some way of reconciling it, maybe, but you don't discuss our enterprises, and I wonder what you have to say about it.
I'm unfamiliar with the case. I apologize, Your Honor. I submit, Your Honor, that the question, when we get to the question of the limitation.
Is there any, let me ask another variation of it. Was there any claim in the district court of the traditional defense, which is entrapment?
Yes.
Your client claimed to be predisposed to tell the truth, but he was entrapped into lying?
Not in that sense, Judge.
Well,
in the sense
no
of a perjury trap.
No. Look, entrapment is a particular defense, and it entails lack of predisposition. So that's the question I'm asking. Was there any argument that your client was predisposed to tell the truth, but that somehow he was tricked or inveigled or
no.
forced to lie?
No, there was not.
Okay.
In the district court, the government argued that the defendant had no standing to raise the issue regarding the treaty. The Supreme Court in United States versus Rauscher spoke to that, and in that case, they said that the defendant could bring, if necessary, a writ of habeas corpus. That would seem to answer the question of standing.
Standing has, as bad as jurisdiction, standing has nothing to do with this. Standing means injury in fact and redressability. The question is not whether somebody has suffered injury in fact. I mean, being in prison is injury in fact, and it's redressable because we can reverse. The technical question is whether there is a private enforcement right for the treaties. Now, although the briefs here don't discuss it, we recently held, three years ago, that the Geneva Consular Conventions, which deal with taking aliens before consular officials after their arrest, create no enforceable rights. The pertinent question here, I would think, is whether our FCN treaty with the United Kingdom, which has the extradition requirement in it, creates enforceable rights. Enforceable in private litigation.
The cases cited in our brief, I think, answer that question in the affirmative.
How
yes,
would that
they
be
do.
Consistent with what we said about the consular treaty?
Judge, I must confess I'm not familiar with that case.
Okay.
But in Kerr, they talk about the fact that the defendant may bring a writ of habeas corpus to enforce his rights. In several other cases, the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th, not just the 9th, Your Honor, have the right to raise the issue. The government, although the distinction between those cases which deal with abduction and kidnapping as opposed to cases that deal with extradition, sought not to deal with that issue, sought not to address it at all in their brief. They merely relied on the two cases, Mata and Marizano, both of which are abduction cases. The answer to those cases is found in Cruz, which says that an illegal arrest is never a defense to the indictment. There is no question that he had standing. The next question that Your Honors must address, it seems to me, is when the tolling occurred. How much credit should Burke receive on his sentence while on parole? The government says that the date should be tolled on September 8th, yet it offers absolutely no explanation as to why that date, as opposed to a different date, should be the tolling date. In the district court, they had originally said he should be given credit for 4 months. They used the word generous. In this court, they've said 2 weeks. They call that generous. The fact is that when they file the motion for rule to show cause, they're seeking the end of the, in that case, supervision, but in actuality, parole. And it's only when the judge's order is entered, unless they can prove otherwise, that the tolling would take. But they haven't chosen to do anything about September 8th. So if you give Burke credit for the time that he was on parole, either the time they filed a motion to rule to show cause, the time the judge ruled, Burke's sentence had been already completed before he ever left England. And for that reason, when the government says to the district court...
I don't know what this has to do with anything. This is baffling to me. Whether his sentence had ended or not, he comes to the United States, he commits a crime. Why would the date of expiration of his earlier sentence be a defense to a new crime?
They brought him here to commit that crime, Judge. That was their purpose and their intention. It isn't as if he arrived here of his own volition.
We're back to my earlier question. I understand, I might understand an entrapment defense, but no entrapment defense was offered, and you seem to concede that the requirements of entrapment are not met. If the entrapment defense is not made, it's perfectly fine for prosecutors or investigators to induce people to commit crimes. They do it every day. come up to people and offer to buy or sell drugs. They induce them to commit crimes. It's not a defense other than as entrapment provides.
This has a different additive, a different fact. What are we to make of their statements to the British court in order to get him here? Did they lie to the court? Did they just forget to say that as soon as he gets here, we're not really concerned about this supervised release portion of his sentence. What we want to do is get jurisdiction of him, so we give him the subpoena, give him the immunity order, and let him do what we know he will do. But they don't tell that to the British court. And in this case, both Rusher and Kerr talk about...
All your client had to do was tell the truth.
That's their contention that it's not the truth. They knew what he was going to say. They didn't have a valid reason for putting him there.
But, by the way, on what date did he commit his bank robbery?
The bank robbery?
Yeah.
I believe those crimes are all committed in the early 90s. I'm not sure of the precise date. I believe 91.
No. You see, one of the threads here is the claim that the term of supervised release was invalid because the bank robbery was committed before November 1, 1987. And the assumption seems to be that until then, there was no such thing as supervised release. Actually, supervised release went into force in September 1986. The party's assumption about the 1987 date is incorrect. Neither side seems to be aware of Ghazlan Peretz against the United States, another Supreme Court decision. So if the original offense was committed after September of 86 or so, it looks like the term of supervised release was perfectly valid, and there was no problem with the continuing custody.
What happens to the government's confession of error in the district court?
But you can't tell me the critical date. I'll ask the prosecutor.
Mr. Nash, you dropped a card that's in front of the table over here. I wouldn't knock myself off and get around on this side. You can pick it up.
Thank you, Judge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Nash. Ms. MacArthur.
May it please the court, my name is Diane MacArthur, and I stand before you representing the United States.
Do you know when his original offense was?
His offense, Your Honor, was in 1986, but unfortunately, Judge, I don't have the specific dates.
You don't know whether it's before or after the enactment of the supervised release statute.
I do not, Judge. I'm happy
and
to provide.
It's very surprising that all of this stuff occurs before Judge Lindbergh without any attention, so far as I can see, to the dates on which these statutes are enacted or the Supreme Court's holding in Ghazlan Peretz. Anyway, please proceed.
Your Honors, I wish to assure the court that I did not lie to the House of Lords or in connection with the extradition proceeding. I did not bring Mr. Burke over here with a specific purpose of entrapping him in the grand jury. I brought him over here to finalize the extradition proceeding, which had already been commenced. And once he was here, I wished to speak with him in order to further investigation into what happened on the day that Jeffrey Erickson attempted to escape. The extradition argument in this case fails for a number of reasons, as Your Honor has already noted some of them. First and foremost, this court has consistently held that it is well established that an individual does not have standing to challenge an extradition treaty or its violation.
Why are you using the word standing? Standing means injury in fact and redressability. Mr. Burke is in prison. That's injury in fact. It is redressable because we can reverse. This cannot possibly have anything to do with standing. Now, it might have to do with whether there is a private remedy for a violation of a treaty. That was the question that we dealt with in the Geneva Consular Convention cases. But it's not standing. It's not even related to standing.
So we won't hear the word standing from you anymore.
It will not be uttered, Your Honor.
Fire away.
Okay. In the past, I will phrase it this way, when this court has considered an individual's claim concerning a violation or an alleged violation of an extradition treaty, the court has looked first to determine whether or not the sovereign involved has filed a protest. No such protest was filed in this case. And the cases citing that proposition, as far as we know, are still good law in this circuit. For that reason, Your Honors, we do not believe that Mr. Burke may appropriately raise a contest concerning the extradition in this matter. But even if he could, his claim also fails on the fact that there was no violation of the rule of specialty in this case. Mr. Burke was prosecuted here. The indictment and the complaint which was filed were for a new crime which he committed. And clearly that type of action by the United States is contemplated within the very extradition treaty with which Mr. Burke now wishes to wrap himself. But even if he were out of time, or we were out of time, when he came here, which we don't concede, we feel that he was properly extradited with remaining time on his parole, it doesn't matter. As Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook just pointed out, even if we were out of time, the fact that he was here allowed us to proceed against him for that new crime. He is not a suppressible fruit of any type of technical violation, and we could proceed. I also know, Judge, in keeping with that same thought, that if what Mr. Nash says is true, if for some reason we were out of time, if then Mr. Burke, for example, committed a murder while he was here and we were out of time, it seems that Mr. Nash is claiming that he could not be prosecuted for such an egregious act. Clearly that cannot be the case. We were entitled to proceed based on the new crime he committed.
I don't think that's what he said or even intimated. I think what he said was you brought him here for a different purpose. I assume you didn't bring him here to commit murder.
We did not.
On your original theory.
Nor did we bring him here to commit perjury, Your Honor. Once he was here, though, as Judge Easterbrook noted, we were amply entitled to question him. Mr. Nash did say or tried to create some aura of impropriety in the way in which Mr. Burke was handled on his very first day in this country. There was absolutely no impropriety there whatsoever. When he was brought here, he was brought in the custody of U.S. Marshals. He was not questioned or interrogated by two FBI agents. Indeed, it was one FBI agent and a U.S. Marshal who brought him to the FBI office. Mr. Burke immediately asked what it was that he was being brought there for, and one of the agents responded that he was going to be asked questions about the Erickson escape attempt. He was immediately presented with a Miranda waiver form, which he refused to sign, and he invoked his right to counsel. The questioning then ceased. There was no interrogation. At that point, he was served with a grand jury subpoena. Again, nothing in violation of a treaty, something that we were entitled to do because I wished to question him about the proceeding. He was then brought before a magistrate judge, something which may not have even been required, but something that I arranged because I was concerned about the length of delay with the Christmas holiday. And it was the judge who set the January 9th date. Thereafter, Mr. Burke's lawyer didn't complain, nor did he try to have Mr. Burke released prior to Judge Lindbergh's ruling in December of 2001 about the supervised release violation. I'm telling this court that when Mr. Burke did appear before the grand jury, I did not trap him into committing perjury. It was not clear that Mr. Burke was going to keep the same
thing. The defense of entrapment isn't here.
That is correct.
So you don't have to discuss it, I don't think.
I wish to remind the court, though, of which the court is aware from looking through the underlying materials, that the district court did consider the perjury trap claim that has been raised, not entrapment, Your Honor, but perjury trap, and found that there was no question about the propriety of the government's motivations, about my motivations.
Look, you're not a witness in this case. Testifying about your motives on appeal is not an available option. I wish you would stop.
I apologize, Judge, but the point I simply wish
to
make...
We are limited to the record in this case, not to testimony taken in the Court of Appeals.
Understood, Judge. Then I refer the court to the district court's finding, which indicated that there was no impropriety, that the government's reasons for putting him in were indeed material and germane to an ongoing grand jury investigation. And that, quite frankly, should end the issue concerning a perjury trap argument. If there are no other questions of the court, I will sit down. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. MacArthur. Anything further, Mr. Nash?
I wish to comment on the use of the word standing. That is the words that are used in the various cases that discuss the issue. That is the question that the government raised and won on in the district court. As to the question that Your Honor addressed to me earlier about entrapment and perjury trap, the argument was made in the district court that the government knew exactly what Burke was going to say when they brought him here. That in that sense, surely he...
That's the very argument that led to the reversal in the Court of Appeals in our enterprises, and which the Supreme Court rejected when it reversed that decision. It said, that's no defense. That's the holding of our enterprise.
I understand. But the difference here is that they brought him here under the guise of bringing him here for service of the other sentence. That was not their primary purpose. Their primary purpose was to give him the subpoena, give him the immunity order, knowing exactly what he would say, prosecuting him then for perjury and punishing him for the murder. In that the escape of Erickson and the two murders. That was their intention. And we can do all we want to cover it over, but that clearly is what they did. They brought him here the 22nd. They never get around to the sentence till December of 2001. The first thing they address is to give him that subpoena. If Your Honors have no other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.